Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Jason Kelly, and welcome to Bloomberg Business of Sports. Happy Memorial Day. It's a strange one, to say the least. So much is different about the world, and so much is different, obviously, in the world of sports and fitness. A guy that I've gotten to know over the years is Rick Stolmeyer. He's the CEO, the founder of MindBody. And if you don't know what MindBody is, if you've ever been to a boutique studio, you've used it. They are responsible for scheduling and processing of payments and all sorts of things for thousands upon thousands of gyms and yoga studios, Pilates studios around the world. Rick is an incredibly thoughtful guy. He's working on a book right now. And as you'll hear in this conversation, he is thinking very broadly, but also very specifically about what this means for us as business people, even for us as humans. Check it out. So, Rick, it's great to get some time with you. You and I have gotten to know each other over the years, and I feel like it's such a critical moment, a catalytic moment right now for the fitness industry. I guess I want to start by just setting the table a little bit. Remind us, remind me and our listeners, sort of what MindBody is, because you really are and have been at the core of this fitness movement and have an intimate understanding of how this works that very few people, if anybody, has.
Well, Jason, thank you for that. It's great to be speaking with you again. And this is truly a pivotal moment, of course, for the world and for the entire wellness and fitness movement as well. So my background, my co-founder, Blake Beltram, and I, we started MindBody in the year 2000. And what we saw happening was this emergence of the boutique fitness movement. It was distinctly different than the health and racket sports clubs that had characterized fitness in the 80s and 90s. And they had a distinct set of business operating requirements. They had a scheduling need. They had a staff management need. They had a CRM opportunity and a desire to do all this via, you know, this new thing called the web to do online booking. So we built MindBody out of that, started in my garage in October 2000, and now looking at it backwards and, you know, connecting the dots, looking backwards, as Steve Jobs said, we can see that we launched our business right at the early stages of what was the second wave of wellness, and have just seen fabulous growth over the last 20 years. And, you know, right up until March 13th, 2020, saw this third wave that really was powered by cloud technology and connected devices and mobile technology in the cloud going into its second stage. So we saw fabulous growth in the 2020s in the headlights right before COVID-19 just utterly interrupted that wave.
So I want to get to the present wave and that end and maybe where we go next. But let's go back to the first, if we can, because this is something you and I have talked about before. I've written about it. I'm fascinated by it. I mean, this really starts in the 80s, right?
It does. Yeah. You know, and when you look at it backwards, you can see a really clean connection to the emergence of a new generation into their 30s. You know, we think of our 30s as our real adulthood. And when we recognize, as human beings, we're no longer kids anymore. We need to get serious about our lives, get serious about our careers, get serious about taking care of ourselves. And that's when you see these big waves start. So, of course, the baby boom generation hitting their 30s, right as we went into the decade of the 80s. And all kinds of societal changes happened at that moment. And one of them was the emergence of fitness. And that's when you saw endurance sports, you know, cycling, triathlons became very popular. Racket sports became hugely popular in that time. The International Health and Racket Sports Association, which is the largest organization of fitness today, was born in 1981. Most of the large health club brands that we've known so well in the past several decades happened in that period. 24-Hour Fitness, Crunch Fitness, Equinox, LA Fitness. These brands all emerged in the 80s. And it was empowered. In each one of these waves, you see that there's a technological component that's enabling it. And, of course, the technological component in the 80s was PCs.
Right.
You now had the ability to automate the critical activity of these health clubs, and that critical activity was simply billing the memberships. So you saw the health club industry emerge out of what was kind of the small footprint, sweaty gyms of the 60s and 70s into these multi-purpose clubs that served both men and women. They had group exercise going on, and they could run the memberships of thousands of people. And at the same time, the other top technology at the time was videotape. And so the emergence of VHS, and for those of us old enough to remember, Beta was at the same time. That's when you saw, you know, the Jane Fonda workout. You saw Richard Simmons sweating with the oldies. And that brought the concepts of group exercise into the living room of millions of people. And that wave really continued all the way through the mid-90s until you had the next generation emerging, which was around 96, 97. That, of course, was my generation. It's Gen X.
Yeah.
And the Gen Xers, when we reached our 30s, a little bit different personalities than the boomers, significantly different personalities, more independent, more individualistic, more pragmatic, perhaps. And that's when you saw this proliferation of the small boutique studios. So the micro gym movement and the studio movement started in the late 90s. And that's where you had a much more personal touch. You had less people coming in, but the amount of benefit being given to those people was much higher. You know, this is the spin studios, yoga studios, Pilates, gyrotonic. This is when the boot camp started. High-intensity interval training was invented during this time. And so that was actually the environment that MindBody was born in, right in the year 2000, to meet the requirements of that group. And, of course, with the enabling technology was the Internet.
Right.
The ability to link the data of hundreds of locations, the ability to enable online bookings, which solved a major problem, and that was the birth of MindBody, among others. And then in the decade of 2010, what you had, of course, was the emergence of millennials. And with millennials, this is the first generation raised with the Internet. This is when now the smartphones are online. This is when cloud technologies enable things. Like, for example, aggregation of enormous amounts of data. So ClassPass was born in that time. MindBody, we released the MindBody app. We became a consumer brand in the decade of the 2010s. And then you saw this wave. What's exciting about these waves is that, let's go all the way back to the boomers, they're still going to the clubs.
Right.
And many of them adopted the boutique fitness practices. And the Gen Xers, of course, were still out there. Because we're all living longer than ever before. So these waves are generally additive. And, you know, it takes us all the way up to, 2 months ago.
Right. So let me ask you, Chris, before we get to that, I also want to focus in on exactly what you just said, because I think it's such a critical point. This notion that it's additive and this notion that despite some bumps along the way and some shifts in modality and shifts in what may be popular at any given time, the sort of mega trend remains intact. What is it about fitness and wellness more broadly that is ultimately appealing to people? Because it feels like ultimately this is as core gets to our very being, not to go too big on it, but it does feel that way.
It is indeed, and it's core to the very being of people who are living in the higher levels of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So if you think about it, most of our ancestors, for almost entirety of human history, have lived in subsistence, which is the bottom two rungs of Maslow's hierarchy. If you can picture that pyramid, at the bottom was physiological needs. Basically, you know, that's food, water, safety, or food, water, shelter. Mm-hmm. And then there's basically physical safety. And that's what, you know, most of our ancestors were dealing with up until the end of World War II. And at the end of World War II, you started seeing millions of people per year emerging into this new middle class. and then ultimately many of them to the upper middle class and the more affluent levels. And when you're at that level, your mind can shift to now thinking about the things that are really much more deeply meaningful, love, belonging, relationships, self-esteem, and ultimately the very pinnacle of self-actualization, meaning actually realizing what your life should be about. And I think there is that point in all of our lives, those of us that are lucky enough to be in the middle class or above, where we realize that without a body that works, everything else is irrelevant. You know, you can't take it with you. And your path is going to be shorter and harder if you don't take care of your physical body. And then it even starts going down that, because wellness is about way more than just physical fitness. That's the cornerstone. You know, without a body that works, we don't have time to think about our social well-being, thinking about our emotional well-being, getting some sense of purpose in our lives. And so this concept of the seven dimensions of wellness is extremely important and has become the principal driver of the vast majority of humanity. I mean, north of 2 billion people now are in the middle class or above. And while we can talk about how certain societies, well, the middle class hasn't done as well, perhaps in North America as they did in the prior decades, if you go out with a longer lens and look at the whole of the world, we've never had this many people living outside of subsistence. And that has been this giant force driving the fitness industry in particular, and of course the overall wellness industry as well, over the last two decades.
So let's talk about this moment, because I feel like that is exactly where we are right now. And in terms of having a group of people, and it's, I think, important to point out, very important point, which is we are talking about an educated and ultimately affluent to very affluent group of people that we're talking about here. I mean, you and I are talking in, you know, late May of 2020, the world has been fundamentally changed, and we've been reminded of the fact that, you know, different people are living very different lives. We are seeing record unemployment, all of those different things. And yet, for a segment of the population, of which you and I are very fortunate to be a part of, people are more worried in some ways about their well-being, their wellness, both physical and mental. And I do wonder this moment what you make of it.
Well, there's a lot here to unpack, isn't there? And yeah, it's important to all of us that we try to get into focus in this. You know, we're staring into a misty future and trying to understand, you know, what is this new so-called normal that we're going to live in? And I think we can anchor ourselves in certain fundamental truths. Let's start with the first thing, that human beings don't flourish in isolation. I think we all know people right now in our lives, and perhaps even in our own households, whose mental well-being, perhaps even physical well-being, has been diminished in the last mm-hmm. couple of months. And that's really, of course, of great concern, because as we know about COVID, COVID is striking the people who are in poor shape the worst. So, you know, the so-called pre-existing conditions, obesity, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, type 2 diabetes, these things are predominantly preventable and predominantly caused by a sedentary lifestyle and insufficient nutrition, or the wrong nutrition. And so I think that this period of time is shining a spotlight on how important it is to get the whole of society in better shape. And that doesn't mean that everybody has to go from being a couch potato to being an athlete. But even a moderate amount of exercise, even just incremental improvements in one's diet, can substantially change your health outcomes. And I think COVID has drawn that into sharp relief. And as we emerge out of this crisis and the data starts getting analyzed and they start drawing these correlations, our hope at MindBody is that the people who pay for healthcare, and that is the employers, the insurers, and the governments of the world, are going to recognize that we have a global imperative to improve all of our fitness.
Right.
And I think that portends very well for the future of our industry and, of course, for the future of humanity, because when you get somebody moving more and you get them eating a little bit better, everything gets better in their lives.
Right.
You know, but it's hard to get people over that hump, right? That's why those teachers, those trainers, those therapists are so important, because they're the ones that can actually help the individual make a material change in their lives. So that's something we believe is true. The second, of course, is, you know, we clearly are in a recession now. The only debate is how long and deep this recession is. Well, let's assume that it's a hard one. Like, this is on par with the Great Recession of 2007, 2008, 2009, or maybe even a little worse. Just if we start with that assumption, I'm not saying that I know that to be true, because I'm certainly no expert in macroeconomics.
But I think we can agree that we are in a recession and it is going to be deep and potentially long. I think we can take that as a given.
Yeah. Well, I certainly happen to agree with you. And so given that, well, what do we think is going to happen? Because obviously what that does is it puts it reduces that number of people that have discretionary income and the ability to invest in their own well-being. But you hit on something important for the people, the current business owners and operators in the wellness industry. The vast majority of their clientele were already the affluent.
Right.
And what we saw in the Great Recession of 07, 08, 09 is that, you know, imagine this dual-income professional couple. And one partner has lost their job and the other one has had their bonus taken away. You know, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to defer that, you know, that Caribbean vacation. They're going to maybe put off buying the new car, the home improvement. Maybe they're not going to upsize to the bigger home. But they're not putting off their health club. They're not putting off their exercise routine. In fact, what we saw in the Great Recession is people actually doubled down on it.
Right.
And we saw that most of the big brands that we know today in boutique fitness and wellness, so Orange Theory Fitness, F45, Pure Bar, Bar 3, Daily Method, Bar Method, Yoga Works, Core Power Yoga, most of them actually emerged in the middle of economic crisis. And in my conversations with the business leaders of both the bigger brands as well as the strong local brands, so we call them the local tigers, their plan to invest coming out of this crisis, and they see an opportunity. And so we believe that the industry is actually going to reaccelerate quite quickly out of this. The question is, what are people going to be doing?
Right. Well, you anticipated my next question, because I see them accelerating. I agree with you to some extent, but unlike the last crisis, which was a financial one, this is a health crisis at its core, and human behavior has changed and presumably will change on a relatively permanent basis. So what does that acceleration look like?
Well, it's clearly going to be led by virtual experiences. And led by is an important qualifier, because all of the data that we've looked at, and we've been researching, you know, in the midst of this crisis, we've been running polls of consumers and business owners to ask them what their intentions are. The vast majority of consumers are saying, now these are consumers that were already engaged in predominantly boutique fitness through the MindBody app. We asked them, first of all, have you adopted virtual practices, you know, streaming video, mm-hmm. Video on demand? And of course, a large percentage of them have done that. And the question, of course, is what do you plan to do after the crisis lifts and you're able to return to these businesses? Will you? The vast majority, more than 90%, have said they intend to return to their face-to-face offline experiences. And about half of those have said, and I will continue the virtual as a
right.
supplement. A complementary activity, because even somebody that was highly engaged was probably only going to the studio a couple of times a week. So there's plenty of opportunity to supplement that with the accessibility and affordability of the at-home experience. And, you know, you're right. Like, so my dad is 88 years old, and we got him a personal trainer about 6 months ago. I wish I could take credit for this. It was actually my wife's idea. And he just loved his personal trainer and would show up, and this guy would give him these exercises designed for elders. You know, it's about strength and balance and avoiding injury. Anyway, he's doing it now on his iPad. My 88-year-old dad is taking live streaming classes and sessions on his iPad. So this crisis has trained all of us on how easy it is to do that, and we're not going to forget that easily. But it, it we don't believe that people will lose their hunger for the face-to-face. In fact, it may even be amplified in the years ahead.
Yeah.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
I do wonder, though, Rick, just to challenge you on this a little bit. You know, we talk a lot about, and we think a lot about the restaurant industry, for instance. And, you know, in the immediate term, in the short, and maybe even to midterm, basically being able to make ends meet to survive. You know, that the business model is crimped at best and devastated at worst. Ultimately, we are talking about, when it comes to boutique fitness, a lot of small businesses in many cases. And I do wonder about the viability in the short term, basically being able to survive, and then on the other side, being able to find that right mix of things to charge the right amount that make them viable businesses.
It's clearly going to be challenging, and I think it is a pretty close analog to the restaurants and the boutique fitness studios. These are both experiences that we, prior to COVID, were spending a lot of time and money on. And so, you know, as I recall my Econ 101 class in college, if you have a supply that's been crimped, and crimping is the right word, and let me just add into that, I think this will be a time in which many of these boutique wellness studio owners just throw in the towel.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, this is the time when you go, how committed am I really? How hard do I really want to work for this? And so, you know, perhaps a quarter of the industry that we see today, of the bricks and mortar locations we saw before COVID, probably won't be there by the end of the year. And you know, keep in mind, by the way, underlying this has always been this kind of like steady flow of people opening up their doors and trying to make a go of it, and you know, only half of them are there 2 years later. So there's always been this underlying natural churn. And what we've seen historically is that once a business owner gets past her second year, well, that's when if she's gotten that far, her chances of long-term flourishing are actually quite high, because she's developed her following, she's perfected her craft and her business model, and those businesses can go on for decades. So I think we'll see, it's like a shaking of the tree. We're going to see a lot of people just capitulate, and that's probably helpful in the near term, because what it's going to do is enable those who are more committed to have a more viable business model. And so now you take a spin studio where there were 30 bikes, and now there can only be 12 bikes to give those distancing. Instead of the classes being stacked back-to-back with a five-minute changeover, now you need 15 minutes or 20 minutes for a total wipe down and sanitation of everything. You can't have people queuing, you can't have people just like mingling outside, because there's no way to maintain social distance when the next batch of people are coming in. You add all that up, and you just don't have the capacity to deliver as many sessions as you did pre-COVID. You know, what estimates? If I had to throw a dart on the wall, maybe 60% capacity prior to the crisis. So Econ 101, if we assume there's still sufficient demand, if a quarter of the storefronts have gone away, and if the storefronts remaining only have 60% of their prior capacity, what happens to the price? It has to go up.
Right.
And so I think the price of a nice meal in, you know, in Soho is going to go up. I think the price of a boutique wellness experience is going to go up. It will be it'll be something, again, that'll need to be, in the early days at least, highly targeted at the affluent.
Yeah.
Who don't care if the class costs $25 or $35 or $40. They just want the class. And I think you can help ease the sting of that for those who aren't as affluent, because you could offer hybrid memberships. Mm-hmm. So you have also, the class has only, you know, 12 people in it in a spin class, but you've got a bike at home and you connect that bike. And by the way, that thing that Peloton's doing today is going to get totally democratized. The ability to link up a machine to a cloud server and mash up your cardiovascular output to the output of the machine, that is now democratized. We offer that capability to our customers at MindBody. It's called FitMetrics. And you're going to start seeing people deploying this in their homes with a myriad different providers. So I could have a practice where I'm going into the face-to-face experience maybe two or three times a month, and I'm doing a streaming class other times. Right. So you could imagine hybrid memberships that give you a certain amount of face-to-face experiences and then unlimited access to streaming.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I have been thinking, obviously, a lot about this, and I do think about that at-home piece a lot. And I think I've told you before that, you know, when Peloton first came on the scene a few years ago, we were at a moment where I thought, you know what, doesn't make sense. That's a backward step. You know, we've come out of the basement in many ways, and we want to be in these boutiques. We want to be around other people. I certainly, and I own this, I've told John Foley this, the CEO of Peloton, founder and CEO of Peloton, that you know, I think I missed in many ways the power of the virtual community and the power of technology in all of this. And you understand this a lot better than I do. I do wonder, to pick up exactly where you were talking about, how quickly, if we can even ballpark it, has this accelerated this online and at home trend, sort of, which I think was an underlying trend and now feels like a mega trend. I mean, has COVID accelerated that 5 years, 10 years? Like, help give me some context here.
I think 5 years is a good number because, you know, as we were mapping out this particular wave of fitness and thinking about what's coming next, you know, the natural arc is when the Gen Zs hit their 30s. Well, that's going to start happening in actually about 7 or 8 years. And so, you know, it's not a clean cutoff, is it? I mean, generations are just a way to kind of understand things in a broad perspective and aren't definitive necessarily. But
certainly you're disrupted by something like COVID, right? You know, it's like you think about like big economic shocks or, you know, something of this scale, obviously that generations are deeply affected. All generations are deeply affected by something this big and exogenous.
Well, exactly. In fact, you know, and if you go back to read the original books, the books by Howe and Strauss, you know, in the early 90s, the people who crafted this whole generational theory, that's exactly what they said. Big disruptive events can change the timeline, and I think that's happening here. And so one of the ways that's happening is how instantly comfortable we're all getting with virtualized cloud connected experiences. And you know, imagine how much harder this would have been if COVID had hit 5 years ago.
I know.
I mean, it would have been as disruptive as this has been, seamlessness with which we all moved to Zoom meetings and the existence of Facebook Live and the existence of Instagram video, and of course, just the predominance of YouTube. All of these things weren't there even 5 years ago to the degree they are now. And so I think this has probably accelerated the timeline 5 to 7 years to kind of land that one. And when you do this kind of disruptive shift, it's not a clean wave anymore, is it? Like the wave just crashed on rocks.
Right. Right.
And so there's this kind of messiness that it means a lot of business churn, and a lot of rapid business creation. So I think business formation in the space will accelerate. I think clearly, you know, Peloton and Mirror, this is extremely fortunate for them. And the adoption rates have been fantastic. The reality we all got to remember, though, is they're not going to own it.
Right? Right.
This is way too easy to do what they're doing. And there is something about having a relationship even if it's predominantly virtual, a relationship with your teacher and your trainer. And yes, you can have that to some degree through a Peloton or a Mirror, but the idea of a, like a local and authentic experience with your local teacher, your trainer, with a therapist, that allows you to actually meet them face to face periodically. That's something that the existing boutique wellness industry can provide.
Right.
And there are hundreds of thousands of those practitioners. So if it was all going to be Peloton and Mirror, then we would all be taking classes from the same few hundred people.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, and 50,000 people in a class. And I don't think that's going to have quite the same appeal.
Yeah. You know, and, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'll come back to that point.
Well, no, I'm going to take a pretty radical shift in the conversation, so finish what you're saying.
Okay. Yeah, okay, so what we see the opportunity of doing, by the way, in this sheltering at home, I have two millennials and two Gen Zs, and the Gen Zs have been teaching me what they've been doing on their devices and computers all day.
Yeah. Like,
because I'm actually experiencing them. And so this idea of these kind of micro social circles that they create globally is really fascinating. So people that are interested in a certain topic and the ability to specialize in the formation of your social group. My 20-year-old is on a system called Discord, and Discord is kind of like Slack for everybody. And you create your own group. It's called a server, and the group creates its own group rules, and they socialize together. They decide if they're going to let somebody into the group. And my daughter is, in fact, running a server with thousands of members on it, and she helped craft the purpose and the rules of this group. You can imagine wellness developing in the same way.
Yeah.
So the relationships are no longer just restricted to the people you have locally. You could be part of a group that has representatives on every continent, every occupied continent, and is centered around a particular set of interests, time of life, professions. And so I think that the definition of what is local and authentic changes.
Yeah.
But that it's still a massive opportunity, and there's a whole new type of wellness business that emerges out of this.
Well, and to your point, I mean, and I think it is something that, as you look at the history of Peloton, just taking that as an example, it is something that I think Peloton opened a lot of our eyes to, which is this notion of a very meaningful community being created among people who never had met each other, but had these commonalities to that exact point. And, you know, I remember going to Peloton Homecoming last May, and seeing all these people sort of come in who had never physically met each other and yet felt deeply connected to each other because they had taken the same class and they had found each other and deepened their relationship virtually on Facebook and other social media platforms. And I do, as you say, it's a really interesting point that Peloton and Mirror and others don't actually own that concept. They helped pioneer it to some extent, but it's going to be much bigger. You know, one of the things I also wonder about, and I'm talking to you, you know, from my home in suburban New York City, and you're out on the West Coast in San Luis Obispo, where you've lived for a long time. One of the things we are talking and thinking a lot about these days is how demographic shifts and folks moving out of cities or moving to different cities, how that affects the broader economy, given how you think about the economy and given that you're on the opposite side of the country from me. How do you see that playing out? I mean, this is coming on a week, you and I are talking, where Facebook, of all people, the company has said half of their workforce is going to be remote in the next 10 years. I have to imagine that affects all the businesses we're talking about too.
Well, it's going to shift where they need to be for sure. And, you know, another anecdote. So my eldest 27-year-old daughter, she and her boyfriend, who's around the same age, he's a senior software engineer. She's a school teacher. They're both living in San Francisco in a house with six other people. Like, this is, you know, classic millennial living in the 2010s. They're done with that.
Yeah.
And in fact, they just signed a lease on their place, a new place in Marin. They're going to get out of the city. Their comment was, and they just went up, they've been sheltering with us for 2 months. They just went back up into the city to check things out. And there's just lots of space for rent already, and the rents are dropping. So I think what's one of the things that I've, as a Gen Xer, I found fascinating about millennials is that they love this living right in these high density neighborhoods, which is something my generation like just didn't love. Like our dreams were around white picket fences and a green grass lawn. And I think there's a real chance that that has permanently shifted as well. As tough as this was for those of us in suburbia, it was much tougher on those people living in the downtown area.
You know, I agree. Yeah. I don't even think it's close. I mean, in terms of, you know, again, I'm talking to you from Westchester County, and I can tell you, like, definitively, my experience has been so starkly different from people who are living in an apartment in New York City, especially if they have a family. You know, the idea that I can go for a walk, that I can, you know, call you from my back porch with birds chirping in the background and all these different things, it is radically different. Well, as we wrap up, I mean, and you've been giving me such a good sense of this already, but I do wonder, because as you've demonstrated through this conversation, you're an incredibly thoughtful guy. You have an understanding of history. And I do wonder, like, how do you think this has changed you? This experience has changed you because you've built this business, you sold it, you've continued to build it, you think about your product, but how do you think it's changed you as a human?
Well, first of all, it has underscored to me the most important things of life, to not take for granted one's own health. The pointlessness of material possessions if the rest of your life isn't in order. For me, I feel incredibly fortunate. You know, my economic well-being isn't at risk in this situation. This has certainly put my business under severe challenge, but there are many, many, many other people that are going to be really suffering in the years ahead. And so for me, my wife and I, we're a lot of thinking about how can we help. Oprah just put out a call, but really interesting what she's just done. She's, you know, giving quite a bit of money already to causes. She's saying those of means are going to need to step up.
Right.
Because our society matters far more than our personal wealth. And, you know, you can't take it with you.
Right.
And so when we see a crisis like this that has interrupted so many people's lives and has caused great suffering for people, it helps you recognize that. And so for me personally, I've always cared a great deal about socioeconomic equality, for people to have equal access to opportunities, to healthcare, to education. This makes me motivated to double down on that because I don't want to live in a world like some third world country where I'm, you know, my kids and I are affluent and we're living behind walls with concertina wire on top. If you've seen countries like that, it's abysmal. You know, you have to hire private security so your kids can get to school. That's not a world I want to live in. So it has sharpened my focus on those issues. Let's fix the societal issues we had before. While at the same time creating an exciting vision for the future so that the younger generations can be excited about where we're going and that there's economic mobility for those that are hardworking and talented and want to achieve in their lives.
Yeah.
So it's refocused me on that.
Well, it definitely feels like we are at all sorts of intersections and pivot points, and the decisions that we make right now over the next few months even are going to have a really strong determination, maybe in a way that you and I have never seen in our lifetime. So grateful to you for spending some time with me, Rick Stolmeyer. I feel like this was long overdue in some cases. Like, we've had some good conversations over the years, but we've never really been able to go deep like this. And I'm sorry it took a pandemic to do it, but really enjoyed it. And hope to see you on one of these coasts before too long.
Thank you, Jason. Well, I really appreciate the work that you're doing and have enjoyed the conversation.
And that was my conversation with Rick Stolmeyer, CEO, co-founder of Mindbody. Really loved catching up with him. We've known each other for a few years. I've been an admirer of him and his work and can't wait to read his book when that comes out. Also can't wait to see what his company and obviously the fitness industry looks like on the other side of this. You've been listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports, the Monday podcast edition. We're here every week, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday with some of the most interesting and we hope informative conversations you hear about the business of sports. I'm Jason Kelly. Check me out on Twitter at Jason Kelly News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.